Chapter 36. It is an unsettled question with me, whether I shall leave Calais something handsome in my will, or whether I shall leave it my malediction. I hate it so much, and yet I am always so very glad to see it, that I am in a state of constant indecision on this subject. When I first made acquaintance with Calais, it was as a maundering young wretch in a clammy perspiration and dripping saline particles, who was conscious of no extremities, but the one great extremity, seasickness, who was a mere bilious torso, with a mislaid headache somewhere in its stomach, who had been put into a horrible swing in Dover Harbor, and had tumbled giddily out of it on the French coast, or the Isle of Man, or anywhere. Times have changed, and now I enter Calais self-reliant and rational. I know where it is beforehand, I keep a lookout for it, I recognize its landmarks, when I see any of them, I am acquainted with its ways, and I know, and I can bear its worst behavior. Malignant Calais. Low-lying alligator, evading the eyesight and discouraging hope. Dodging flat streak, now on this bow, now on that, now anywhere, now everywhere, now nowhere. In vain Cape Grinnes, coming frankly forth into the sea, exhorts the failing to be stout of heart and stomach. Sneaking Calais, prone behind its bar, invites emetically to despair. Even when it can no longer quite conceal itself in its muddy dock, it has an evil way of falling off, as Calais, which is more hopeless than its invisibility. The pier is all but on the bowsprit, and you think you are there. Roll, roar, wash. Calais has retired miles inland, and Dover has burst out to look for it. It has a last dip and slide in its character, as Calais, to be especially commanded to the infernal gods. Thrice accursed be that garrison town, when it dives under the boat's keel, and comes up a league or two to the right, with the packet shivering and spluttering and staring about for it. Not but what I have my animosities towards Dover. I particularly detest Dover for the self-complacency with which it goes to bed. It always goes to bed when I am going to Calais, with a more brilliant display of lamp and candle than any other town. Mr. and Mrs. Birmingham, host and hostess of the Lord Warden Hotel, are my much esteemed friends, but they are too conceited about the comforts of that establishment when the night mail is starting. I know it is a good house to stay at, and I don't want the fact insisted upon in all its warm bright windows at such an hour. I know the warden is a stationary edifice that never rolls or pitches, and I object to its big outline seeming to insist upon that circumstance, and, as it were, to come over me with it, when I am reeling on the deck of the boat. Beshrew the warden likewise, for obstructing that corner, and making the wind so angry as it rushes round. Shall I not know that it blows quite soon enough, without the officious warden's interference? As I wait here on board the night packet, for the southeastern train, to come down with the mail, Dover appears to me to be illuminated for some intensely aggravating festivity in my personal dishonor. All its noises smack of taunting praises of the land, and dispraises of the gloomy sea, and of me for going on it. The drums upon the heights have gone to bed, or I know they would rattle taunts against me for having my unsteady footing on this slippery deck. The many gas eyes of the Marine Parade twinkle in an offensive manner, as if with derision. The distant dogs of Dover bark at me in my misshapen wrappers, as if I were Richard III. A screech, a bell, and two red eyes come gliding down the Admiralty Pier with a smoothness of motion rendered more smooth by the heaving of the boat. The sea makes noises against the pier, as if several hippopotami were lapping at it, and were prevented by circumstances over which they had no control from drinking peaceably. We, the boat, become violently agitated, rumble, hum, scream, roar, and establish an immense family washing day at each paddle box. Bright patches break out in the train as the doors of the post office vans are opened, and instantly stooping figures with sacks upon their backs begin to be beheld among the piles, descending as it would seem in ghostly procession to Davy Jones' locker. The passengers come on board. A few shadowy Frenchmen, with hatboxes shaped like the stoppers of gigantic case bottles, a few shadowy Germans in immense fur coats and boots, a few shadowy Englishmen prepared for the worst, and pretending not to expect it. I cannot disguise from my uncommercial mind the miserable fact that we are a body of outcasts, that the attendants on us are as scant a number as may serve to get rid of us with the least possible delay, that there are no night loungers interested in us, that the unwilling lamps shiver and shudder at us, that the sole object is to commit us to the deep and abandon us. Lo, the two red eyes glaring in increasing distance, and then the very train itself has gone to bed, before we are off. What is the moral support derived by some sea-going amateurs from an umbrella? Why do certain voyagers across the channel always put up that article, and hold it up with a grim and fierce tenacity? A fellow creature near me whom I only know to be a fellow creature, because of his umbrella. Without which he might be a dark bit of cliff, pier, or bulkhead clutches that instrument with a desperate grasp that will not relax until he lands at Calais. Is there any analogy, in certain constitutions, between keeping an umbrella up and keeping the spirits up? A hawser thrown on board with a flop replies stand by. Apostrophe apostrophe stand by, below. Apostrophe half a turn ahead. Half a turn ahead. Apostrophe apostrophe half speed. Apostrophe half speed. Port. Port. Apostrophe apostrophe steady. Apostrophe steady. Go on. Go on. A stout wooden wedge driven in at my right temple, and out at my left, a floating deposit of lukewarm oil in my throat, and a compression of the bridge of my nose in a blunt pair of pincers. These are the personal sensations by which I know we are off, and by which I shall continue to know it until I am on the soil of France. My symptoms have scarcely established themselves comfortably, when two or three skating shadows that have been trying to walk or stand, get flung together, and other two or three shadows in tarpaulin slide with them in two corners, and cover them up. Then the South Foreland lights begin to hiccup at us in a way that bodes no good. It is at about this period that my detestation of Calais knows no bounds. Inwardly I resolve afresh that I never will forgive that hated town. I have done so before, many times, but that is past. Let me register a vow. Implacable animosity to Calais ever that was an awkward sea, and the funnel seams of my opinion, for it gives a complaining roar. The wind blows stiffly from the northeast, the sea runs high, we ship a deal of water, the night is dark and cold, and the shapeless passengers lie about in melancholy bundles, as if they were sorted out for the laundress. But for my own uncommercial part I cannot pretend that I am much inconvenienced by any of these things. A general howling, whistling, flopping, gurgling, and scooping, I am aware of, and a general knocking about of nature, but the impressions I receive are very vague. In a sweet faint temper, something like the smell of damaged oranges, I think I should feel languidly benevolent, if I had time. I have not time, because I am under a curious compulsion, to occupy myself with the Irish melodies. Rich and rare were the gems she wore, apostrophe is the particular melody to which I find myself devoted. I sing it to myself in the most charming manner, and with the greatest expression. Now and then, I raise my head, I am sitting on the hardest of wet seats, in the most uncomfortable of wet attitudes, but I don't mind it. And notice that I am a whirling shuttlecock between a fiery battledore of a lighthouse on the French coast, and a fiery battledore of a lighthouse on the English coast. But I don't notice it particularly, except to feel envenomed in my hatred of Calais. Then I go on again, rich and rare were the GMs she wore, and a bright gold ring on her Y and she bore, but oh her beauty was far beyond. I am particularly proud of my execution here, when I become aware of another awkward shock from the sea, and another protest from the funnel, and a fellow creature at the paddle box more audibly indisposed than I think he need, be her sparkling gems, or snow white wand, But oh, her beauty was far beyond another awkward one here, and the fellow creature with the umbrella down, and picked up her sparkling GMs, or her port. Steady. Snow White fellow creature at the paddle box very selfishly audible, bump, roar, wash, white wand. Apostrophe, as my execution of the Irish melodies partakes of my imperfect perceptions of what is going on around me, so what is going on around me becomes something else than what it is. The stokers open the furnace doors below to feed the fires, and I am again on the box of the old Exeter Telegraph fast coach, and that is the light of the forever extinguished coach lamps, and the gleam on the hatches and paddle boxes is their gleam on cottages and haystacks, and the monotonous noise of the engines is the steady jingle of the splendid team. Anon, the intermittent funnel roar of protest at every violent roll becomes the regular blast of a high-pressure engine, and I recognize the exceedingly explosive steamer in which I ascended the Mississippi when the American Civil War was not, and when only its causes were. A fragment of mast on which the light of a lantern falls, an end of rope, and a jerking block or so, become suggestive of Franconi's circus at Paris, where I shall be this very night mayhap, for it must be morning now, and they dance to the self-same time and tune as the trained steed, Black Raven. What may be the speciality of these waves as they come rushing on, I cannot desert the pressing demands made upon me by the gems she wore, to inquire, but they are charged with something about Robinson Crusoe, and I think it was in Yarmouth Roads that he first went a seafaring, and was near foundering.
What a terrific sound that word had for me when I was a boy,
in his first gale of wind. Still, through all this, I must ask her who was she, I wonder. For the 50th time, and without ever stopping, does she not fear to stray, so lone and lovely through this bleak way, and are Aaron's sons so good or so cold, as not to be tempted by more fellow creatures at the paddle box or gold? Sir Knight, I feel not the least alarm, no son of Aaron will offer me harm, for though they love fellow creature with umbrella down again and golden store, Sir Knight, they what a tremendous one love honor and virtue more. For though they love stewards with a bull's eye bright, they'll trouble you for your ticket, sir, of passage tonight. I freely admit it to be a miserable piece of human weakness and inconsistency, but I no sooner become conscious of those last words from the steward than I begin to soften towards Calais. Whereas I have been vindictively wishing that those Calais burghers who came out of their town by a short cut into the history of England, with those fatal ropes round their necks by which they have since been towed into so many cartoons, had all been hanged on the spot, I now begin to regard them as highly respectable and virtuous tradesmen. Looking about me, I see the light of Cape Grin as well astern of the boat on the davits to leeward, and the light of Calais Harbor undeniably at its old tricks, but still ahead and shining. Sentiments of forgiveness of Calais, not to say of attachment to Calais, begin to expand my bosom. I have weak notions that I will stay there a day or two on my way back. A faded and recumbent stranger pausing in a profound reverie over the rim of a basin asks me what kind of place Calais is. I tell him, heaven forgive me, a very agreeable place indeed, rather hilly than otherwise. So strangely goes the time, and on the whole so quickly, though still I seem to have been on board a week, that I am bumped, rolled, gurgled, washed, and pitched into Calais Harbor before her maiden smile has finally lighted her through the green isle, when blessed forever is she who relied on entering Calais at the top of the tide. For we have not to land tonight down among those slimy timbers covered with green hair, as if it were the mermaid's favorite combing place, where one crawls to the surface of the jetty, like a stranded shrimp, but we go steaming up the harbor to the railway station quay. And as we go, the sea washes in and out among piles and planks, with dead heavy beats and in quite a furious manner whereof we are proud, and the lamps shake in the wind, and the bells of Calais striking one seem to send their vibrations struggling against troubled air, as we have come struggling against troubled water.
And now, in the sudden relief and wiping of faces, everybody on board seems to have had a prodigious double toothout, and to be this very instant free of the dentist's hands. And now we all know for the first time how wet and cold we are, and how salt we are. And now I love Calais with my heart of hearts. Hotel Dessen. But in this one case it is not a vocal cry. It is but a bright luster in the eyes of the cheery representative of that best of inns, Hotel Mures. Hotel de France. Hotel de Calais. The Royal Hotel, sir, Engage House. You going to Paris, sir? Your baggage, register fruit, sir? Bless ye, my touters, bless ye, my commissioners, bless ye, my hungry-eyed mysteries in caps of a military form, who are always here, day or night, fair weather or foul, seeking inscrutable jobs which I never see you get. Bless ye, my custom house officers in green and gray, permit me to grasp the welcome hands that descend into my traveling bag, one on each side, and meet at the bottom, to give my change of linen a peculiar shake-up, as if it were a measure of chaff or grain. I have nothing to declare, Monsieur Le Douanier, except that when I cease to breathe, Calais will be found written on my heart. No article liable to local duty have I with me, Monsieur l'Officier de l'Octroi, unless the overflowing of a breast devoted to your charming town should be in that wise chargeable. Ah, see at the gangway by the twinkling lantern, my dearest brother and friend, he once of the passport office, he who collects the names. May he be forever changeless in his button black surtout, with his notebook in his hand, and his tall black hat, surmounting his round, smiling, patient face. Let us embrace, my dearest brother. I am yours a tout jamais for the whole of ever. Calais up and doing at the railway station, and Calais down and dreaming in its bed. Calais with something of an ancient, and fish-like smell about it, and Calais blown and sea-washed pure. Calais represented at the buffet by savory roast fowls, hot coffee, cognac, and Bordeaux, and Calais represented everywhere by flitting persons with a monomania for changing money, though I never shall be able to understand in my present state of existence how they live by it, but I suppose I should, if I understood the currency question. Calais and Rose, and Calais and the tale, forgive one who has deeply wronged you. I was not fully aware of it on the other side, but I meant Dover. Ding, ding. To the carriages, gentlemen the travelers. Ascend then, gentlemen the travelers, for Hazebrouck, Lille, Douai, Bruxelles, Arras, Amiens, and Paris. I, humble representative of the uncommercial interest, ascend with the rest. The train is light tonight, and I share my compartment with but two fellow travelers. One, a compatriot in an obsolete cravat, who thinks it a quite unaccountable thing that they don't keep London time on the French railway, and who is made angry by my modestly suggesting the possibility of Paris time being more in their way. The other, a young priest, with a very small bird in a very small cage, who feeds the small bird with a quill, and then puts him up in the network above his head, where he advances twittering to his front wires, and seems to address me in an electioneering manner. The compatriot who crossed in the boat, and whom I judged to be some person of distinction, as he was shut up, like a stately species of rabbit, in a private hutch on deck, and the young priest who joined us at Calais, are soon asleep, and then the bird and I have it all to ourselves. A stormy night still, a night that sweeps the wires of the electric telegraph with a wild and fitful hand. A night so very stormy, with the added storm of the train progress through it, that when the guard comes clambering round to mark the tickets, while we are at full speed, a really horrible performance in an express train, though he holds onto the open window by his elbows in the most deliberate manner, he stands in such a whirlwind that I grip him fast by the collar, and feel it next to manslaughter to let him go.
Still, when he is gone, the small bird remains at his front wires feebly twittering to me, twittering and twittering, until, leaning back in my place and looking at him in drowsy fascination, I find that he seems to jog my memory as we rush along. On commercial travels does the small bird, have lain in their idle thriftless way through all this range of swamp and dike, as through many other odd places. And about here, as you very well know, are the queer old stone farmhouses, approached by drawbridges, and the windmills, that you get at by boats. Here, are the lands where the women hoe and dig, paddling canoe-wise from field to field, and here are the cabarets and other peasant houses. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.